me on IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have another great show for all of you today. My guest will be Sally Edwards. She is the co-founder of the Chemical Footprint Project, and she works with the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production. And she's going to come on and talk to us about how to design products to make them healthier and safer for the environment. And she's been working in this area for many, many years, and she's going to share with us the work that she does and how we can start thinking about things in a different way. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, I would like to talk to you about some wonderful things going on in and around the city and some things that were in the news. First, in the news this past week, the New York Times had a great article on the GMO movement. It was a great article. They were looking at the perspective and reflecting back on the genetically modified organisms and the introduction of that model to agriculture and reevaluating it and looking at it and saying, you know what, all the things that we were promised, the things that GMOs were supposed to do, they were supposed to give us greater yields, they were supposed to allow us to spray with less pesticides and use less herbicides, and none of that really came to be. This is a great article. It compares our food system with European models, and our yields have not gone up at all. And as a matter of fact, we now use five times as much pesticides and herbicides as before. And Monsanto is even saying that by 2025, each seed will have 14 traits that will allow farmers to spray five different types of herbicides. So they're now promoting seeds that will allow us to even spray more pesticides and herbicides. And it's just such a bad model. We need to really press our new government that we will be finding out about next week. We need to press them, let them know that this has got to change. We have to really mobilize together and push for a return to sustainable agriculture. Those models work, and they're much better for the environment, and this model is just not working. And so it's just a wonderful article, really looking back objectively on the genetically modified organism movement and really saying it didn't work. What we were promised didn't end up happening, and we need to turn it around. So thank you to New York Times. Another great article that I saw in the Times is about Italian winemaking, talking about, you know, really connecting to the earth cycles, you know, the Farmer's Almanac, which, you know, was published, you know, so long ago, over 100 years ago, is now, you know, is something that farmers still use today. And yet Rudolf Steiner, the Australian philosopher who developed biodynamics, his model is really taking hold in vineyards around the world. And this is talking about in Italy, some of the farmers that are raising grapes in a biodynamic way, which means that you are not only taking care of the earth, but you're using animals and, you know, and planting vegetables and other crops as well. You know, the monoculture as we know it today in farming just doesn't work on any scale. And to really have a sustainable organic ecosystem, you really need to have many different things on the farm, including animals and vegetables and grapes. So it's really a wonderful model and a great article. So you can find those articles and links to them on my website at iegreen.com. Also, all these events that I'm going to tell you about right now, you can also find on my website. And you know, I spend a lot of time trying to gather events that are going on in the New York City area, and even some of them are outside the New York City area. You know, a farm-based education workshop that's taking place up in Concord, Mass. You know, I put that on because it's, you know, these farm-based education workshops are so so powerful and so important to bring people together who care about this. And, you know, so it's a whole regional thing as well as just local. But tonight, I am attending the River Fund New York's Silver Anniversary Gala. I'm really excited. They're honoring Gwyneth Paltrow. But the River Fund is the organization that I partner with to bring a big Thanksgiving feast and Christmas dinner to homeless people on the streets of Queens. And the River Fund is an incredible food pantry. They've been working now for the past 25 years, and this is their 25th anniversary gala. And they started, you know, as a small little food pantry in the back of my friend's house. And it has just really grown to now being the largest food pantry, or not necessarily the largest in size, but they service the most families of any food pantry in New York City. And they're just great. And so I partner with them to create a Thanksgiving feast for the homeless. And this is really a home-cooked meal, something that they do not get often. It's not industrial-produced Thanksgiving at all, where we're just cooking in some big commercial kitchen. This is home cooking, where people are coming to my home all weekend long, scrubbing potatoes in my bathtub and, you know, and chopping and carving and really working together. And I have over 100 people that come through over the weekend. We prep Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, and we serve on Tuesday at Rufus King Park in Jamaica, Queens. So it's a big, big happening. There's still lots of shifts that are open, so if anybody listening is interested in participating in this fundraiser, you can go and find the link to sign up to help on my website. Also on November 4th, the Food Policy for Breakfast series continues, and this is sponsored by Hunter College's Food Policy Council. This one is The Power of Community Gardens in New York City. All of these events are just, they're wonderful. If you're ever available when they take place, they are free. They're from 8:30 in the morning, where they put out a nice healthy breakfast, and they end around 10:15 in the morning. But it's just wonderful. So this one is on community gardens in New York City. Definitely worth checking out. Slow Food New York City is having their monthly happy hour at Jimmy's 43. That is a wonderful slow food inspired restaurant where everything is sourced consciously. They open their doors up very often for slow food events. And this is a monthly happy hour where you can really come down and learn about slow food and meet people that are working on the ground up in the slow food community in New York City. So that's worth going to on Monday, November 7th from 7 to 9 p.m. November 5th is a Chinese auction and dinner to support the garden at St. Francis. That's on Long Island. That's, again, a fundraiser. They're having lots of Chinese food, both meat and vegetarian offerings available. And that will be in Belmore. And it's only $18 to purchase tickets, $20 at the door, worth going to. November 5th through the 17th is the United Nations Climate Summit taking place, and that should be a great happening. Another farm-based education conference. Oh, that's the same one. I'm sorry. Forgive me. Another food policy breakfast series. This one is on pesticides, on human and environmental health. That's taking place also up at Hunter College on November 9th. Also worth going to. November 10th, New York City Sierra Club is having a documentary film screening in the city. That should be a wonderful happening. There's actually two. On November 10th, the Sierra Club is having a film screening of the movie Dirt in Long Island at the Copaic Memorial Public Library. And then there's one on November 15th in New York City at the Sundance Film Theater. And I'll be providing some refreshments for that one. So that should be great to go to. And like I said, you can find out about these events on my website, so check those out. I want to share my recipe with you. This week I made a stuffed delicata squash with vegetables and wild rice. Really delicious. I did it at the my cooking retreat that I had here last weekend, and it was loved by everybody, and I want to share it with you. So delicata squash is one of my favorite squashes out there, partly because it cooks up really much quicker than a lot of the other ones, and also because you can eat the skins. And when you roast them in the oven, they become a little bit crispy and just really delicious. And so you don't have to peel them. and they're easy to cut compared to butternut squash and acorn squash, so I love them. So you're going to start with 4 delicata squashes, cut them in half, so you'll have 8 halves. So, and each half, is, you know, if it's a main course, everyone can have one half. If it's a side dish, you can cut those in half and feed even that many more people. 1 onion chopped, 2 carrots diced, 1 tablespoon of chopped garlic, 2 teaspoons grated ginger, 2 peppers diced, 1.5 cups broccoli florets, 2 small baby Japanese eggplants, and you could use one larger one, it's just what I had in my garden, 1 can cannelloni beans drained and rinsed, 1 cups of cherry tomatoes, 1 cup baby Bella mushrooms quartered, 1/2 cup of white wine, 1.5 cups of kale chopped, 1 teaspoon cumin, 3 tablespoons tamari, olive oil to saute, 1 teaspoon salt, 1/2 teaspoon pepper, 1 tablespoon chopped cilantro, and 2 tablespoons chopped parsley, and then I added 2 cups of cooked wild rice. And I started by cutting the squash in half lengthwise, brushed them with olive oil, and I laid them face down and roasted them in an oven at about 375 degrees for only 15 minutes. And you can just check when they're soft. You can pierce it with a fork. And if you can do that, they're ready. And just bring them out of the oven, let them cool down. Meanwhile, you can be sauteing the onions in some olive oil until they're translucent with the garlic and the ginger. Then add the carrots and cook that for about another 4 minutes or so. And you always cook the root vegetables first because you want to get those soft before you start adding the greens. So then I added the broccoli, the steamed eggplant, and the peppers. And I've gotten into steaming my eggplant first now because eggplant, I don't like if it's not cooked all the way through. I think eggplant really needs to be cooked all the way through. But if you're cooking it in oil, it absorbs so much oil that I don't usually like eating it that way. So steaming it first is a great way. I used to also roast it in the oven sometimes. But you want to cook the eggplant in some form before you start stir-frying it. Otherwise, it's just going to absorb too much oil. So you're adding the eggplant and the peppers to the pan and cook that for about another 5 minutes. Then you can add the beans, the cherry tomatoes, and the mushrooms. Cook that down for a little bit. Add the kale and the white wine, and the white wine will help steam the kale and cook that up a little bit quicker. Add the tamari, the salt, the pepper, and the cumin, and continue cooking for about 5 more minutes. So you're kind of creating a little bit of a stew type of dish. Then you're going to add the white wild rice, the parsley, and the cilantro, and just mix all that up. You don't need to cook it anymore at that point because the rice is already cooked, and the parsley and the cilantro are best actually not cooked too much. They taste, you know, freshest when they're not cooked. And then just mix that all up, and then fill the zucchinis with that vegetable mixture. And you're going to bake it in the oven at 375 for another 10 to 15 minutes just to bring all the flavors together. And that is it. Easy, simple, delicious, really great. So enjoy that. And, of course, I love feedback. So if you do make the recipe, please let me know how it is and how you liked it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to you my guest, Sally Edwards. As I said, she's the co-founder of the Chemical Footprint Project, which is designed to recognize corporate leadership in the use of safer chemicals. And she also works at the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production at the University of Massachusetts in Lowell. And she's been working for years, working with all these organizations, really trying to help them think about how they bring products to market. And I'm really thrilled to have her on to tell us more about what she's doing. Welcome, Sally.
Thank you, Bhavani. It's really great to be here.
Great. So I wanted to first ask you if you could just tell us first a little bit, what is the Chemical Footprint Project?
Okay. So let's start with that. So you probably all have heard of a carbon footprint. Most of us now know about companies measuring their carbon footprint, which is measuring their emissions of greenhouse gases that are altering the climate, and companies are working to reduce their footprint. You can also measure your personal carbon footprint, because we all have a carbon footprint depending on the kind of size house we live in, the cars we drive, the number of airplane flights we take in a year. We can all work to, and of course, carbon footprints differ depending on your wealth and how much of the planet you take up through your actions every day. You know, the Americans tend to have a much bigger carbon footprint than
someone living in India.
Exactly. So we took that concept in thinking about a chemical footprint, and we're working with companies. We wanted to find the companies that are really working to reduce their use of toxic chemicals in the products that they made. So we, in the last couple of years, we've designed a survey that companies can take that look at their efforts, their management strategies, their efforts to know what chemicals are in their products, and their efforts to replace hazardous chemicals with safer chemicals in their products. And then the companies that score the highest get recognized as corporate leaders. The program has taken a couple of years to start to develop, and we just actually launched it this past year and published our first report, our first annual report in May. So now we have a second cycle of companies that we're inviting in to report.
Oh, that's great. I didn't realize it was so new.
It's very new. Right.
And so how did you first get into this kind of work to start with? What's your background?
Okay, well, it's sort of a long, I've been doing this for a while, so it's a little bit of a circuitous route, but let me step back. As a teenager, I was very interested. I love nature. I love being out of doors. I came to political consciousness in college as a feminist and an environmentalist. And I studied biology and then went on to graduate school to study public health, particularly environmental health, because I understood that people, I felt like people particularly become motivated to take action when they feel like their health and that of their family are being protected, are being affected, so that if your own health is being affected, you may take more action to protect yourself and protect the planet. I started my official career at EPA, and I worked cleaning up, working with companies to clean up hazardous waste sites, which could have been my career for many years, but I really got more interested in how do we change this process where we're not creating hazardous waste. So then I began to work with companies to look at how they could clean up their manufacturing processes. And then I learned that about 70% of a product's environmental impact is really determined in its design. So I got very interested in product design and how can we design products that are safe and healthy. And I ended up going back and getting a doctorate mid-career that looked at sustainable product design. And the way I think about sustainable product design, it's about the materials and chemicals that make up a product, but it's also about who's making the product, what are the conditions under which that product is made, whether the community where the product is made is benefiting from it. Because, of course, we have a global production system, and often corporations go to places to get products made where they're the most lax regulations and also cheap labor. So often there aren't the kinds of environmental and health, occupational protections in those places where those products are made. So when I think about sustainable products, I'm thinking not only about what are the chemicals and materials for the products, but whether the folks that are making those products are safe and whether their communities are healthy as well. When I did my research, when I did my research for my dissertation, I looked at toy making all over the world, and I particularly focused in on how dolls are made. And I did some case studies looking at. I first went to a factory in Germany that has quite a long tradition of craft production. And I went to a factory that had been making dolls for 100 years to look at the chemicals and materials they used to make their dolls and the working conditions there. And then I went to Peru to a village where women, it's a doll-making cooperative, and it's a it's basically a cooperative that's designed to provide a sustainable livelihood for women there who haven't had a way to be economically independent. And a lot of thought is put into how these dolls are made in the community that's created as a part of this initiative. They're actually dolls that are made, they're Waldorf style dolls, and many people actually in the U.S. and Europe purchase these dolls from
the ones from Germany or the ones from
the ones
Peru?
From, the one from Peru.
Uh-huh.
And then I also looked at, I didn't go to China, but I looked at how the American Girl doll is made. It's, you know, a more typical doll, an expensive, beautiful doll, but a typical, you know, more how a doll is made in an assembly line in a Chinese factory. So I wanted to contrast that to really think again about how do we think about sustainable production. And when I completed that work, as Bhavani said, I'm affiliated with a research institute at UMass, the University of Massachusetts at Lowell, called the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production, and we work with businesses, with communities, with environmental groups, really looking at how to make systems of production more sustainable, but we particularly focused on safer alternatives to toxic chemicals.
I need to just interrupt for a minute. I'm dying to know, what did you find out about the differences in the doll making between Germany, Peru, and then China?
Yeah.
Was it what one would expect?
Yeah, I think it's what one would yes. So what we found in, you know, in Germany, it was really interesting because there's still real attention to the quality of the work environment. The dolls are, they're beautiful dolls. They're not cheap dolls.
Are they the Waldorf style dolls, or are they plastic
some
dolls?
Of them, no, they're cloth dolls,
uh-huh,
for the most part. Some have plastic heads. But they're made, you know, in the craft tradition. The materials for the dolls are, the fabrics are Ecotec certified, meaning that they don't have harmful pesticides in the cotton material, for example. And the women are working in a craft workshop. You know, in many assembly lines, you're just doing the same thing over and over again. In this workshop, women, you know, they might be the ones who do the hair for the doll, or they make all the clothes for the doll, but they have a very congenial work environment, very different than a factory line. You know, in Peru, it's even one step further than that, in that the women bring their children to the place where the dolls are made. There's a daycare center for the children. The women eat together. They're working in community with each other. And in many ways, the community, the founders of this initiative, it's called the KEWAR Project, Q-E-W-A-R, the KEWAR Project in Peru. The founders are one of them's a former Waldorf teacher in Peru, and, you know, he really sees it as an initiative to really build community and support these women. So they sit together in community making these dolls, and if there are conflicts, the conflicts get worked out together. And the men of the community come in and they help with some farming that happens there. So it's a really interesting initiative in that it's really trying to support the entire community. And it was a community that was really ravaged by a civil war. So this has been to kind of do some healing following that.
Mm-hmm. And then the ones in China.
And the ones in China, I didn't get to go to the factory, so this is, you know, secondhand, but just studying about how many products are made in China and other places where the conditions for workers are, you know, long hours, exposure to toxic chemicals, living in dormitories, substandard foods.
Horrible.
And, you know, I think we know a fair amount about that, but, you know, beautiful product, but made often on the backs of folks that, they're coming into the city from rural parts of China because they are looking for opportunity. And many of those folks, they don't stay in that one factory for a long time. They work to get into better factories and to move on into better jobs. But, it's really changed the culture and social structure by so many folks moving from rural areas into the cities.
Mm-hmm. And you actually turned that work into a book. Called Sustainable Product Design in the Global Doll-Making Industry. And you published that in 2009.
Yeah.
And where do people find that? How does that
come to be? I had the opportunity. It's called Beyond Child's Play.
And, sorry.
Yes, I had the opportunity after I wrote my dissertation to publish it as a book, and it's published by Baywood Publishing. You'd be able to get it online. It's actually now Rutledge Press, I think, but I'll give Bhavani the information. I can't say it's a really widely read book, but interestingly, a couple of times over the past years, women who are doll makers have contacted me. Who found the book and are really thinking about what materials do they want to use, who do they want to have make the dolls if they're trying to contract out the doll making, who've really been intrigued by this idea of sustainable product design, that it's about what the product's made of, and it's also about who makes the product and whether they're making a sustainable livelihood from that product.
Mm-hmm. Right, so you're really looking at it from all angles.
Right. So, I when I get my royalty checks, it's about $3 a year. It's never going to be a bestseller. It's never designed to be, but it maybe has had an impact on a couple of folks. And,
uh-huh.
The concept, I think you can apply this concept to blue jeans or, you can apply it to food too.
The other day, and you were talking about, Levi's changing, in order to get the distressed jean look, instead of using a chemical, they're now using a fungus?
Yes, to make their jeans worn. I mean, Levi's is among a number of companies that were targeted a few years back by Greenpeace. Greenpeace had a campaign called the Detox Campaign, where they were very concerned about the pollution in the rivers in China. China's rapidly industrializing, as many people know. And, of course, you've probably seen many pictures of air pollution in China. But the rivers are also really polluted, and that's certainly affecting rural people, as well as actually people all throughout China who depend on local agriculture
and
as well.
And fish. Yeah.
And so Greenpeace targeted a group of large brands with the idea that, brands like Levi's and Nike and Puma and Adidas and others that make footwear and apparel, they often share factories, and they were collectively responsible for this pollution. And an interesting thing happened as a result of that campaign, in that the companies that are competitors came together and formed a group called Zero Discharge of Hazardous Chemicals, and set a goal that, and so it's called ZDHC, they set a goal that by 2020 they would not be discharging hazardous chemicals into these rivers, which is a really, very aspirational goal. We'll see if they get there.
Mm-hmm.
But what it means is now there's a whole structure in these companies, this group. You can go to ZDHC to look up the companies that are part of this. But they meet regularly, and they've agreed on a set of chemicals that they're trying to eliminate from manufacturing. They have a set that, cannot be used in manufacturing. But they're also, Levi's is really leading in screening the chemistry up front, really thinking about what are the chemistries that can be used that are safe for making their products. And they're encouraging the other companies that are part of CDHC to use that, because again, these companies share factories, so they all really need to be changing their practices if they're going to achieve this goal. So that's an interesting example of a...
That sounds hopeful.
Yeah.
That sounds
really
great.
I'm always, you know, as I said to Bhavani, through my affiliation with the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production, I've spent the last decade or so really working on finding safer alternatives to toxic chemicals. And I'm not a chemist. I'm not the one in the lab designing the molecule, but I'm facilitating dialogue to make that happen. And I'm always, you know, I think I said to Bhavani that I've gone from working to clean up hazardous waste sites to really thinking about design. And for me, it's a much more hopeful place to be. When you're cleaning up the problem, it can get really discouraging. But when you're working with environmental groups and community groups and companies that are really trying to find solutions and design things differently, it can feel hopeful. It helps me feel hopeful every day.
Yeah, absolutely. A much better place to be in. Let's take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I actually want to hear some examples of chemicals and consumer products that you're, you know, raising awareness about and trying to clean up.
Okay.
So, everyone, don't go anywhere. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. Be right back.
Stay tuned to PRN.FM for more empowering ideas from progressive voices. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
South of the border, down Mexico.
I'm Johnny Mueller, host of The Expat Files, living in Latin America. Heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Sunday at 12:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It's a show where you'll learn how to work, play, do business, or retire and live the life of Riley. Yes, an amazing number of first world people like you are jumping off the stateside treadmill and voting with their feet. And surprise, surprise, they're finding there really is an American dream. But it's not in Seattle, Milwaukee, or Cleveland anymore. It's down here in Latin America. So be sure to tune in to the Expat Files to find out how you can live the good life on a measly Social Security check.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today, Dr. Sally Edwards, is co-founder of the Chemical Footprint Project, and we're just talking about chemicals in consumer products. And right before the break, I was asking her, what are some examples of chemicals that people find in consumer products that are harmful to our health and the environment?
Well, thanks. Thanks again for having me, Bhavani. So first, let me start by saying that let's just talk about chemicals for a minute. Just about everything that I'm looking at in this room is made up of chemicals, and they're very important. They serve very important functions in products, right? Whether they're holding fragrances, whether they're lubricants, whether they're solvents. We use chemicals, and they serve many important functions. But along with the functions that chemicals serve, often there are risks to human health and the environment. And when chemists we've had many years of chemists making molecules that meet functions, but a chemist is not a toxicologist. So a chemist may make a product that later on we find causes harm to human health or the environment. So let me give you some examples of some chemicals in consumer products. For example, you probably heard of the chemical triclosan or or triclocarbon. They're often used. You'll see that in antibacterial soaps. And these are products that can be ingested or absorbed through the skin, and they can disrupt our hormonal systems, and they also can impact aquatic life. We've been using these chemicals are particularly important. They've been used in hospitals to kill germs, but then they become much more widely used in all sorts of products. And it was just this year that the FDA has banned the marketing of products with triclosan and triclocarbon because they found they really were no more effective than just using soap and water. So that's an example of a chemical that's been proliferated out through many of our cleaning products, and it really doesn't even need to be there. Phthalates are chemicals that are in many, many personal care products. They hold the fragrance in those products. And they're also found in plastics because they can soften plastics. And they're chemicals that, again, we call them endocrine disruptors. In other words, they interfere with our hormonal systems. Fluorinated chemicals are used in cookware, in outdoor apparel, in carpeting and clothing, and they can either be used for stain resistance or water repellency. Now, again, if you're on a mountain doing some kind of technical climbing, you probably want a water repellent tent. And might need this chemical being used in that product, but it's another chemical that's proliferated in many, many products, children's backpacks, products that really probably don't need to have these chemicals.
So is there any type of safety that these chemicals go through before they're used, or is it like, the chemicals that they put in our food where they use them and then it's up to us to be the guinea pigs and, years later show that we're getting sick from it and then have to fight to get them out of the market?
Well, it's unfortunately more like the second. We have a law called the Toxic Substances Control Act, which finally this year was reformed after we have a new law. But when it was first in the 70s, when the law was passed, about 60,000 chemicals were quote-unquote grandfathered in. In other words, many, many of the chemicals that are in commerce today really have not been tested for safety. New chemicals are, and with this new law, there'll be more constraints on and more testing of chemicals. But what it means is there are many chemicals in commerce that we only learn after the fact, and then it's sort of until we can prove an association with that chemical and a health effect. It's very hard to get it off the market. Europe has stricter regulations than the U.S. Because of the weak federal regulation, many states have put in place regulations on specific chemicals. The work of environmental advocacy groups has been really important. There's a group called Safer Chemicals, Healthy Families, and a number of other groups that have really worked to educate consumers about.
The Environmental Working Group has a great, great website.
Right. Environmental Working Group, I was going to mention that because when people are looking for safer products for their families, the Environmental Working Group, also Good Guide, and the Silence, there's another organization, Silent Spring, that does a lot of research. Yes, inspired by Rachel Carson's book, that does a lot of research on toxic chemicals and consumer products, and they've just come up with an app. Actually, Environmental Working Group, Good Guide, and Silent Spring. I think Silent Spring's app is called Detox Me. And you can go to these apps when you're in the store and get information about the health impacts of different products. Environmental Working Group has what they call the Skin Deep website where you can look up cosmetics and see what the ingredients in those cosmetics and personal care products are.
The Food Tank and the James Beard Foundation just came out with an organic good food guide, as well. So the coming up with these environmental working group also has one for food. But you know, these guides are really there to assist us, and we all really should really use them more because they are very helpful. One of the things that I think about a lot when talking about consumer products is suntan lotion. I know it's a personal care product, but parents are so concerned about their kids. You know, I always think about kids mostly because their bodies are still developing. And when you lather on sunscreen with all the chemicals in them, and our skin being so absorbent and our largest organ, it's just horrible because you're just putting these chemicals on your children day after day after day without any thought of it being toxic. So,
yeah, and the FDA has been pretty, there are some problematic chemicals in sunscreens. The FDA has been very slow to regulate them, and that's why Environmental Working Group has a good sunscreen guide that they put out every year.
Right.
And it's a good place for people to go when as Bhavani said, it's the chemicals that we're putting in our bodies and on our skin that, of course, we're particularly concerned about. But, there are other, even, for example, our couches. Unless you've bought a couch since 2015, any furniture that has made of foam has flame retardants in it. And, as couches degrade over time, those chemicals are being released into the environment. They're now, you can now buy couches without added flame retardants.
Even on our mattresses. I mean, that's why there's this whole organic mattress movement.
Right.
I don't know what the chemical is. Do you know what the chemical is that's in mattresses that's so toxic?
And well, it's likely to be the flame retardant.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You know, you're sleeping on this mattress 8 hours every day, hopefully, if you're getting a good night's sleep.
Yeah.
And, 7 days a week. And you're inhaling the outgases from those chemicals.
Yeah, this is, again, it comes back to design. What the manufacturers of furniture have learned, and this is through some regulation, particularly because regulations have finally changed in California, which has allowed companies to reformulate their products, that you can use different materials that are inherently flame retardant, like wool or cotton, not cotton, wool, but wool and some other fibers, so that you don't need to add the flame retardants to these products. One thing I wanted to say, though, it's like I think it's really important to understand that we can't really shop our way out of this problem. I mean, we can be. It's really important to be green consumers and informed consumers, but we also need to be citizen activists. We need to let our government know. We need to let corporations know that we want safe and healthy products, and it's only through demanding those. And then also thinking about what is it that we need, because we live in a world where we're told to buy, if we have the money, we're told, and even if we don't, we're told to do it on credit, to buy. There are lots of stuff that we don't need and stuff that we end up, becoming trash often soon after we get it. So it's also rethinking what is it we need. And that's why, I'm really happy to see that the sharing economy, for example, has become that's become something that people really are becoming part of, where they're not necessarily buying a lawnmower, but they might be sharing one with their neighbor, or Zipcar. You don't need to have a car. You can, this idea of products as services. Sometimes you really don't need to own something, but you want to be able to use something. So there are lots of really interesting models for not consuming so much stuff, and really thinking about sufficiency instead of, aspiring to have more and bigger for everything.
Of everything, right.
Yeah.
You talk about the green chemistry. What's green chemistry?
Okay.
How's that different than other chemistry?
Well, green chemistry is a science that aims to reduce or eliminate the use and generation of hazardous substances in designing new molecules. So it's really this idea of one of my colleagues just wrote a book called Chemicals Without Harm. So again, understanding we need chemicals to meet all sorts of functions of society, but we don't need to design them in a way that's harmful. Now that's a challenge. Most chemists are not trained in green chemistry. There's a lot of my colleagues who are working with universities to get, there are now green chemistry programs in some universities around the country, but it's not, again, in most chemistry programs, chemists aren't required to graduate having taken a toxicology program, so they, a toxicology course, so they may not understand the connection between the molecule they're creating and the harm it could do to human health or the environment. But the green chemistry movement is really growing. And what one of the things that means is that chemists are using, rather than using petroleum to make plastics and chemicals, they're using bio-based feedstocks. So they might be using agricultural sources like sugarcane. And then, of course, that can bring up issues around land use if you're using land to make plastic rather than food. So even better, there are some companies that are experimenting with using biomass waste, like wood chips, straw, and other materials that are waste products of agriculture and turning them into plastic. Even some companies are using methane gas or using, you know, waste products from biogas facilities to, and they, what, with the, either the sugar cane or the methane, you can actually make a polymer which you can make into plastics and other materials. So probably most people, when you, if you've ever seen compostable tableware, plates and silver, you know, plates and forks and spoons, those are the ones that are labeled compostable. Most of them are made out of something called polylactic acid, which is actually a corn-based plastic. So these are plastics that actually can be returned to the earth and broken down. It doesn't work that well to throw them in your backyard composting pile. It really has to go to a commercial composting facility because you need very high temperatures. But unlike fossil fuel-based plastic, it will actually break down.
Mm-hmm. And then you're also seeing, you know, the paper goods made out of, they're not paper, made out of leaves and bamboo.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah.
You know, so those are really nice and are also compostable.
Right.
I've been using them more and more in events that I do.
Right. So it's all part of thinking about, you know, we would call it, in thinking about a principle for sustainable product, making it appropriately durable, because you know a plate that that you're going to eat food on at a event, we shouldn't use a plastic plate that's then going to take 100 years to degrade. It should be something that can degrade within months and be mm-hmm. you know returned to the soil versus something like a dining room table that you might want to have made out of beautiful wood that then can be passed down through generations. You want that to be a very durable product, but things that we're only going to use for a few minutes, we really want them to be made out of something that can be returned to the earth. And that's, you know, that's the idea behind a concept called Cradle to Cradle, and also you'll be hearing that people talk now a lot about the circular economy, where
yeah,
we again,
talk about that.
It's the idea that we're designing products, you know, out of safe materials, and we're designing products that can be taken apart, remanufactured, recycled. So instead of an economy, the most of our economy now is an economy people would call take, make, waste. We extract raw materials, we make products, and much of what we make becomes trash actually really quickly because many of our products are designed with something we call planned obsolescence. They're designed so that they're not very upgradable. And it's partly marketing where you think you need the latest product, where your product may be perfectly good the way it is, but it's also that maybe the plug-in no longer works, or you know, it's not designed to just be improved over time. It's really designed that you have to throw it away and buy something new.
Again, I think that goes into policy, like you were talking about, becoming activists, because in other countries, the European Union, I know, they have a law where every cell phone has the same plug, so that when you get a new cell phone, when your cell phone breaks or you want to upgrade, you don't have to buy a new plug for the house, a new plug for the car, a new docking station, all these different things that you talk about. It's planned consumerism in a sense. You know, they, you know, Apple wants us to have to buy a new docking station, a new plug, a new thing every time they come up with a new phone. And, you know, they work that into the into their marketing strategy so that they you have to keep buying more and more. And we need, they need to think more on a global standpoint as to what's being wasted. And I think I was sharing with you, you know, I wanted to reupholster my chaise lounge in the backyard, and it cost me almost the same amount to get new material as it would have to get a whole new chair. And yet I just didn't want to have to throw it, the chair out. The chair was fine, but the material was broken. And, you know, they designed the products so that it doesn't make sense for us to, you know, get the materials, or they don't sell the materials easily, so that you really end up trashing things that, you know, there is no throwing out. I try to tell people that all the time. I mean, where does it go? When you throw it out, you think, oh, I just threw it out. But where does it go?
Right.
People don't think. It goes to a landfill and sits there in a mound on Staten Island or New Jersey or wherever it is, or in the middle of the ocean. You know, so this whole circular economy is, you know, I think needs to be worked into the policies, because companies, it costs them more money. They're not going
to
do it.
Right, and it means, it really means we have to think about the materials we're making things out of, because you can't really have a circular economy if you're using toxic chemicals. Because then as you take, as you make, when you're making the product and when you're taking the product apart, you can impact human health and the environment. You know, for example, the phones and computers that we use, they're fairly safe in use, but there's many toxic chemicals used to make those products, and then when they're dismantled and taken apart, unless it's done under really safe conditions, people are being, often electronics are dismantled again in countries far away from the U.S. under conditions that are not safe and healthy. So we really need to think again about how do we design products to be made of the safest possible chemicals and materials, so that no matter what part of the product life cycle we're talking about, people in the environment aren't being harmed by them.
Yeah, I think also we need to educate the consumers. I mean, we came up with new light bulbs, but people don't know that you can't just throw those light bulbs in the garbage.
Right.
They need to be recycled, and people don't know that, that those light bulbs, I don't know what's in them. Is it?
It's mercury. In the fluorescent, in the compact fluorescence, it's mercury in those bulbs that you really do not want leaking out into the environment.
Right, and people don't realize that that's changed. You know, they're just thinking these are more efficient light bulbs, saving on my energy, and not realizing on the other end of it there's a toxic component that can't just be thrown away.
It's important for consumers that, I mean, we all want to get a product at the least expensive price, but often cheap prices means that there's been a trade off somewhere. That if you're getting, a company has externalized at the cost of the pollution. You know, if you're often the greener, healthier products, where companies are really trying to internalize those costs. That's why the product might be more expensive, and that often the products you'll find in the dollar stores, for example, are ones that have not been made under safe conditions, and they've been made with the cheapest possible labor, and that's how those prices are so cheap.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, we're almost out of time. Can you tell us what can individuals do to make the better choice? I mean, we talked about the list. But I know, you know, some products come with eco labels. Can you trust those labels?
Well,
where
some
do people
you know
go?
Well, you know, I mentioned a couple of websites, and maybe that's something Bhavani can put on her blog.
Yeah.
But, you know, eco-labels, I guess you need to the ones that you can trust are ones that are third-party certified. You can't just trust a label that says all natural, for example. It needs to be something, there's Green Seal, Eco Logo, the EPA Safer Choice label. Those are all labels that have had a group of stakeholders coming together to really determine safety. It's not the company deciding to put their label on without anyone else auditing or assessing
right.
it. So the other thing to look out for are B corporations. That's a new kind. If you see the letter B on a product, a B corporation is a corporation that's gone through a process. They're corporations that are for social good, so they're trying to make sure that all stakeholders, not just their shareholders, benefit, and they've had to go through an assessment for social and environmental impacts.
Right.
So that's sort of another thing to look for besides an eco label.
Right. And they're looking really at the whole picture. They're
right.
looking also at the people that work there and the environment, that working conditions and
exactly.
fair labor wages and all other things that very often get overlooked.
Yeah, and it's mostly smaller companies, but we're hoping that that movement will grow as well.
Well, we're just about out of time, and we didn't even get to ask you about the Women's Voices for the Earth, which I know is an organization that you're involved with. Just really quick, want to say
Great organization based in Missoula, Montana. It's been around for about 20 years. Really focuses on, again, about on making sure that the chemicals in consumer products are safe, particularly focus on products marketed to women, personal care, cleaning products, and looking at occupations like nail salons, and hair salons where women are working and being exposed to these toxic chemicals. So check out their website, womensvoicesfortheearth.org. I'm on the board of that organization, and they're really doing great work.
Great. I'll share that on my website, too. And everybody, thank you so much for joining me. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and Dr. Sally Edwards has been my guest. See with you all again next week. Have a great rest of the week, and I'll see you next week. Bye.